Hello, and welcome to Life Before Vinyl on Resonance 104.4 FM. This is Adrian Tuttenham, and I'm going to be your guide as we ramble through a miscellany of sounds from the forgotten past. Before the vinyl record became popular in the 1950s, there was already more than 50 years of sound recording history on record. The technology for making those records became standardised over the years, but in the early days there were many strange formats, which nowadays can catch out the unwary collector. Our first record today is an example of this. This is a rare recording of the Chalk Farm Salvation Army Band, conducted by bandmaster A.W. Punchard. At first sight it appears to be just an ordinary, if rather old, record. It's only when you come to play it that the oddities become apparent. If you place the pickup at the outside rim of the record, nothing happens. This is because the record starts from the centre and plays outwards. Then if you try playing it from the centre, still very little happens. The pickup moves across the record, but you only hear scratch. This is because the vibrations in the groove are up and down instead of from side to side. You'll need a specially adapted pickup to play them. Finally, you get a sound, but it's far too slow, because this record was made to be played at 90 revolutions per minute. So, at last we've got there. The speed is right, the pickup is right, and we are playing from the centre outwards. So now we can hear Liberty March by Broughton. Was Liberty March, played by the Chalk Farm Salvation Army Band, and recorded on a vertical modulation Pathé record at 90 revs a minute from the centre outwards. Well, putting aside all the jokes about French engineering, why on earth did they make a record that way? All becomes apparent when you realise that their copying system was done by dubbing wax discs from masters which were cut on 180 rev a minute cylinders. The speed of 90 revs a minute was half the cylinder speed, and the direction of cut and modulation were set by the geometry of the cylinder copying machine. The whole process was actually a way of getting around some patents that prevented them from copying records by the double electroplating system, which was described by Peter Copeland last week. As Peter explained, this was a complicated chain of positive and negative copies, leading from the master wax, through a matrix, a number of mothers, even more stampers, and finally the actual pressings, which could number millions. The record company kept track of this complicated process by a series of numbers and letters stamped into the various parts. And we can sometimes decode those marks to yield quite a lot of information about the record. Peter Copeland explains.
A convention became established round about the mid-20s, this became universal, whereby the matrix number identifying the original would have a prefix to identify where it came from, and a number to identify which master recording it was, and a take number to show how many goes the performers had had to try and get a good performance. Further downstream, there were the manufacturing pressing plants who had to identify lumps of shiny metal, and they couldn't even have a label. And so there would be additional marks added at the factory to show the generations through which the mass production of stampers went. There would be a master negative, which would be the very, very first way of getting the sound off the original wax or whatever the material was. And that would be the precious original, like a newspaper photograph negative, which would go into the vaults and all the other copies would be taken from that. Then there would be a number of metal positives coming from that negative, and these would generally have letters A, B, C, D and so on. And then there would be any number of stampers coming off each of those negatives, and they would also have numbers. And so the general convention was to go number, letter, number through the generations, and each one would have a different combination of numbers and letters, and these different numbers and letters would be at slightly different places with respect to the standard label on the records, so that somebody could look at a particular make of record and say, well, in that case, the stamper code is going to be to the right of the label, and look to the right of the label, and there, just about visible, would be the stamper code. All this gradually evolved, which is why I said that it took some time before the standards had settled down to this form. And by about the late 20s, it had been standardised almost everywhere.
This seemed like a good time to test out Peter's knowledge, so we fished a random record out of his pile of throwouts and sat down to examine it. There's a picture of the actual record on the Programme 12 page of the Life Before Vinyl website. Right, so we found you a record typical of the sort of thing that turns up in junk shops, and in my opinion, quite rightly so. However, there's information on this disc other than the music, so can you start by telling me what you can see? Well, first of all, which way up have you got it?
Well, I'm holding it the right way up, which in this particular case involves having the dog and trumpet trademark at the top of the label.
So it's an HMV.
His master's voice,
so
yes.
So it's their code system we're going to be looking at first, then.
That's right.
Right, so what marks can you see around the label and what do they mean?
Well, the first one is beneath the label at 6 o'clock with respect to the label, and it says 0EA18503-3A. And that can be broken down into three parts. The 0EA is called the prefix, and a 0 means that it's a 10-inch record. If it had been a 12-inch record, it would have been a 2 instead. EA means England first series of matrix numbers. There was an EB, for example, for private issues, which weren't for commercial distribution. Then the five-digit figure 18503 is something that would have appeared on the box which contained the master tape on the His Master's Voice archive shelves.
Oh, so this one was made from tape?
This one was mastered on tape first, so they could edit it and get around some of the problems of timing, of trying to get the music to start within 3 revolutions of the disc, which was the standard adopted for this particular company. And then finally, we have a take number, which in this case is 3A. This means it's the 3rd performance of this piece of music in the original studios at Abbey Road. And the A means that it's the 1st transfer from that performance into the disc format from the master tape.
Right, so they only needed 1 go in order to get it from tape to disc.
That's right.
So it's 3A.
Yes.
Right, okay, so that's a lot of information in just a very few numbers.
Yes, indeed. And yet there's more.
Right.
I haven't told you yet what is at 9 o'clock with respect to the label. That is to the left. And there we have the coding for the original negative made from the original cut groove. And this case, it is an A, meaning it's the 1st go at making a negative. And they got it right 1st time in this case.
Right. So that code just goes A, B, C, does it?
Yes.
Right.
And then to the right of the label, we have got something rather more complicated, which is to establish the stampers. And this can be a guide to people to tell immediately whether a record might have been a bestseller or not, because a stamper would only last for something in the order of 1,000 pressings, yet it might be a million seller. In this particular case, the stamper code is GM. And this is a little bit exotic because it's rather like a hidden code. It isn't immediately self-evident that that, in fact, means 14. And it means that because G is the 1st letter of the word gramophone and M is the 4th letter of the word gramophone. So this means that it came from stamper number 14.
So that would have been about 14,000 records at a guess.
That's right.
Can you tell me what the title is?
The Ballad of Davy Crockett. And this version is sung by Max Bygraves.
So I'm sure our listeners are going to love that.
Here, kids, hand me that old guitar. I'm going to tell you a story about a famous man. Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee, the greenest state in the land of the free. Raised in the woods so he knew every tree. He killed him a bear when he was only 3. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. Fought single-handed through the Injun War, till the Creeks was whipped and peace was in store. And while he was handling this risky chore, he built himself a legend forevermore. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. He gave his word and he gave his hand that his Injun friends could keep their land. The rest of his life he took the stand that justice was due every redskin band. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. Now he'd lost his love and grief was gold. In his heart he wanted to leave it all and lose himself in the forest toll. But no, he answered instead, his country's call. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. He went off to Congress and served a spell, fixing up the government and laws as well. Took over Washington, so we hear tell, and pitched up the crack in the Liberty Bell. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. Rocket, king of the wild frontier. His land is biggest, and his land is best. From grassy plains to the mountain crest, he's ahead of us all, a meet in the test. And following his legend right into the west.
Davy,
of the wild frontier.
You're listening to Life Before Vinyl on Resonance 104.4 FM. If you haven't discovered it already, Life Before Vinyl has its own website, which you can find by following a link from the Resonance FM programme listings page or by typing Life Before Vinyl into a search engine. The main page has links for each programme in the series, giving information on the records played and further links to websites with details of the artists and composers. Peter Copeland, retired technical manager of the British Library National Sound Archive, has just described how the Matrix, Mother and Stamper codes can be read off a record. But why was such a complicated system of stamper codes needed?
The main reason was simply so that in the quality check department, if they heard a click on stamper number 14, they could immediately scrap all those records, melt them down and do them again, and get all the others, which had, shall we say, GH, meaning 16, they would be OK.
So why was this complicated code used? Why didn't they just put the numbers on there?
I think it was a case that every factory has its own system, and because stampers are sometimes changing from one factory to another, then you have to label them in such a way that it's unambiguous.
So if it was a different company, you would expect a different code in that position?
Yes, indeed. And in fact, I have here an Australian version of His Master's Voice record. And because of the complicated record company politics, by the time that record manufacture was becoming a global industry, the Australian pressing is made in a factory which originally belonged to a different company, Columbia, and they have a totally different code because they also made records for their deadly rivals in Britain, Decca. So we have a complicated situation. In Australia, there was only one factory working for the two leading British record companies. And so you can see the muddles that can occur if you don't have unambiguous codes. In the case of this one, the stamper code is a letter B. And you know that the letter B does not occur in the word gramophone. This is a Decca type lettering system. And they use the word Buckingham for reasons which are not at all clear, but the same applies. No repeated letters. And the letter B means that it's the first stamper, in fact.
Because so it's the first stamper, numbered on a Decca system to produce an HMV record in a Columbia factory in Australia.
That's right. And to make matters worse, it's an American recording, so the Matrix number's different.
Thank you.
That was Jelly Roll Morton and his Red Hot Peppers playing Little Lawrence. You're listening to Life Before Vinyl on Resonance 104.4 FM. One of the many interesting records to have its secrets unravelled by Peter Copeland's expert knowledge is a nondescript-looking Columbia from 1934 called Electric Girl. The tune is credited to Helmberg and was composed before the First World War, probably in Germany. The orchestra is billed as Orchestra Raymond, Columbia's name for a group of session men. And the other side of the disc is Glowworm Intermezzo by Paul Linker, which by 1934 would have been regarded as an old potboiler. What particularly drew attention to this record was the spirited performance of this pair of hackneyed old tunes. It was almost as if the players were having an informal session and enjoying themselves. That theory was further supported when Peter's expert ear picked up a couple of points where the recording engineer was a little late at fading up some of the microphones. And this was on the second take, according to the Matrix code. It sounded as though this might have been an unrehearsed bit of fun which somehow got recorded and issued. The final clue came when Peter looked up the studio Matrix tables to get the exact recording date. It turns out that this was the last wax recorded in the afternoon before the studio shut down for the annual holidays, and it had been preceded by a very undemanding morning's work. They were indeed having a bit of fun before they went away for a fortnight at the seaside. That's going to be the last record for today. So this is Adrian Tutnam, looking forward to having your company again next week. Next week's programme will be the final one in this series. But if you want to hear the series again, or if you missed any of the earlier programmes, there will be a chance to hear the whole thing when it's repeated later this year. In the meantime, here is Orchestra Raymond, which probably includes Billy Mayerl on piano and several other famous players, letting their hair down with Electric Girl.